to music scene. It's a beacon for music arts, songwriting, Americana, roots music, things that you can't hear anywhere else. It's amazing. It's the local flavor that when you're driving across the country, you hope to find, you know, while you're on a road trip or something. You're not just hearing the same stuff on the streaming platforms, whatever, and you get to hear what's here. You get to hear what came here before, and it's really great. It's an education that everybody needs to hear these incredible songs. It's just an amazing opportunity for local and regional musicians.
Listen for his music and other independent artists here on KPFT Houston.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT Houston and also a podcast out there in the digital realm. I am Brett Cullum, and in this edition, I talk to Jack Valensky about a Pride banner district for the Montrose neighborhood. Then I speak with author John Marullo about Houston's second annual LGBTQIA+ author fair. That event is free to the public and will be at the Montrose Center Saturday, August 1st from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Then finally, I talk with the cast of A Nice Indian Boy. It's an LGBTQIA+ romantic comedy play that will be at the Asia Society Texas Center starting on July 31st. Queer Voices is produced by Brian Hlavinka, Deborah Moncrief Bell, and me, Brett Cullum. And we start right now. Hi there, this is Brett Cullum, and today I am joined by a guest that I feel almost embarrassed to introduce, Jack Valensky. You've been on the show so many times, an iconic activist, past host of Queer Voices, and someone I often refer to as Mr. Pride. He helped lead the city into having a nighttime parade and formalize the organization that put it on. So thank you for joining me, Jack.
Sure, happy to be here.
Now, the rainbow crosswalks of Westheimer and Taft were removed by the city of Houston in October of 2025. And it was this move that manifested the idea to erase the LGBTQIA+ community from the Montrose. But now we may have another option. What is that? What are we looking at?
So in 1995, when I was part of Pride, they got the Lower Westheimer Banner District. I honestly wasn't very much involved in it because it was one of the board members or somebody. I honestly don't remember who it was. But they went through the process. It was approved by the city, and that year in 1995, from what I remember or understand, was we actually had pink triangles up there on those poles between approximately Taft and Upon, I believe. And once that was done, we had a simple process of calling the vendor and say, put them up, take them down. They couldn't stay up there forever. There was a certain time period of like maybe 100 days that they could be up there. And then when they moved the parade downtown, the people at Pride continued putting up the banners, but then I think they forgot about it, or there was a change in leadership, and then it just stopped happening. So either by forgetting or saying, hey, we're not in Montrose anymore, we don't need to do it, or money. It could have been money. And when I was actually walking from my house to where the Rainbow Crossing was, I was on the phone with Councilmember Kamen, and she was talking about how we need to fight this. And I said, hey, I remember that we have a banner district that Pride does. And this should be a really simple story. Unfortunately, it's not so simple or quick. So immediately, I started trying to find out who in the city deals with banners and who at Centerpoint deals with banners, because they go on Centerpoint poles. And it took a while. I kept getting pushed over to like the people who do sign ordinances. And I was pushed to planning. I was pushed to different places. And finally, I found the person. And understandably, this is such a small part of one person's job in both Centerpoint and the city. So finding that person, number one. Number two, they couldn't find the records of it originally being granted. They did find in 2002 that on the city agenda was an extension of the banner district. So we had that. They says, yes, it's valid, but what we need to do is to reapply for it since we don't have the paperwork, and you don't have to go through council because this is something council has to approve, has to be put on the agenda by the mayor. So we all thought it was a simple process. But as we kept moving forward, I got to believe that Public Works, the engineering department, didn't even have an application of how this is supposed to happen, a process. So we kept going back and forth, and this started in October, back and forth about, oh, you need this, you need this, you need to have a map. I supplied them with two maps. They know we want one map. And it just kept going back and forth. And finally, somewhere in May, they said, okay, it looks like we got all the information we need. Just hold on. I got to go to my supervisor. And it sort of stopped there. So, and in the process, the mayor at one time said, I don't think that they ever used the Banner District, which was not true. It also was, did Pride want to pursue this? And I talked to Carrie Ann Morrison. I says, are you interested in this? And she said, yes. And I said, well, since I work for the city, I would be happy to work this process. And she says, fine. All along, she was supportive of doing this. But it was just crazy it took this long. So somewhere in May, when the process stopped, we pretty much figured it went out to the mayor's desk. And somebody actually came, spoke at public session, Kevin Strickland, and asked about it. And the mayor said, well, we're concerned that the city doesn't want to pay for it. We never asked for it to be paid for by the city. But Councilmember Kamen, as when she was still in office, says, I want to use my district funds to pay for the banners. And we said, great. But then the mayor sort of said, I'm worried if we use city money that the governor will come after us because we're using, you know, city money for this. We never asked for it. He then volunteered to use his own money. We never asked for that. As it sort of got stalled in his office, I actually worked with six different council offices to try to get word back of what's happening, what's going on. And it kept circling back to the LGBT chamber that, you know, like they had to okay this. And with all due respect to the chamber, they do great work. This wasn't a chamber project. Nowhere in the history was a chamber involved. In fact, the original banners got up before there was a chamber. And or the chamber in the form it's in now. So we finally got to this point, and then the mayor, after Kevin spoke, he says, okay, I'm going to have a meeting next week. This was about 3 weeks ago. So in the process, I was talking to the council offices and their staff, and finally they had a meeting, and Tammy from the chamber was invited. The chief of staff was there. Councilmember Panzanelli was there. The chief of staff from Salinas's office was there, but Pride was not invited. And so as soon as this meeting, like I said, this is a long story. So I got right after the meeting, I got a call from the chief of staff of Salinas's office explaining what happened. And I kept saying, I don't understand this. Why is the chamber there and why isn't Pride there? My name was on the application. My whole thing was I'm working in conjunction with Pride because they had the original banner district, which the city said was still valid. It's just that they wanted to have new paperwork. And it just kept going back and forth with this. And I think the mayor gets stuck with some things and sometimes just doesn't pull back and look at it. And then finally, about 2 weeks ago, we got a call, and I spoke to more people than I have before in the city, and you know, elected people and their staff. And finally, they said, okay, Pride can do this, but we still needed the physical sign-off. So it was last Tuesday after I went to council, to the public session, and so did Carrie Ann, thanked the mayor for all this work, and we finally got the paperwork. So now it still has to go through CenterPoint. And Pride decided to put out this press release, and that was their choice. I sort of wish they waited until we were further along. It's crazy because all the time I did work in the community, I either get the door shut or get things done or whatever, but it never took this long to get something. And, you know, we're talking, the mayor always talks about efficiency. There was no efficiency. So we're now at the point, we're working with CenterPoint. We're working with the vendor to put the flags up. Our hope is it'll be up before the parade on August 15th, but I have no idea what the bureaucracy of CenterPoint is.
But, so there are actual physical banners ready to go up. Is that what you're telling?
No,
No?
Because we didn't want to spend the money until we knew we could do it.
Okay.
But we're in the process of working with the vendor, who I already worked with, but let's get an exact quote. We have the design. It's the Progressive Rainbow Flag, which was approved by the city. And so that's where we are. The vendor, now the actual brackets that have to go up is part of what the vendor is going to do. Those brackets disappeared because it's been like 10 years since those banners were up. So I don't know whether they fell off or Centerpoint took them off or whatever. So our thing was to try to get this done as soon as possible. So we basically focused on 10 poles from Taft to Montrose. Once this gets up and going, we're going to look forward to extending it further down Westheimer if we can. It's going to cost money. It's probably not a lot of money, but we may, you know, Pride has the money to put them up. We may want to do some fundraising to do this, to continue it, because it's not a lot of money. You know, you put them up, and then it's going to cost money to maintain them, and eventually they'll fade, and we'll have to put different ones up there. And in the meantime, the funny thing is that Pride had already put banners up downtown on the downtown district's banner system. And the downtown district allowed them to do it. So the banners, there were Pride banners up this year. But this is really just something that should have been handled like in a couple weeks. But it took this long. And, you know, we're putting up basically rags on utility poles. This is like the biggest thing. We're not solving the fact that we don't have a non-discrimination ordinance. And there's a lot more important things to do. But I think what this does is, and I remember this after doing Pride every year, or even doing the radio show, every once in a while you get a phone call from somebody who has no connection to the community, who's young, who may be sheltered by their family or their religion, and saying, I didn't know there was a community out there. And as much as we think we've made progress, that niche is still in our community. There may be some young person riding on the 82 bus coming into Montrose and seeing those banners up there, which may say, hey, there may be hope for me.
No, it's a great symbol. And obviously with the crosswalks removed and we don't have a lot of just physical representation. So it's interesting to think about this. But if they do go up before August 15th or in the month of August, how long would they stay up? Would they stay up for a while or would they?
We will keep them up for a couple of months. Hopefully through October, which is History Month. I honestly don't know. I never even asked that question, but we will get that answered about what the cycle is, how long they can be up there. We will hope to be able to maybe do some other things than just that, you know, just the Progressive Flag. We, like I said, we hope to extend it, but it's like, let's just get the first step done. And I got to say that working with Carrie Ann at Pride has been an incredible process. And one of the things, I actually sat down and talked to her a couple weeks ago for a couple hours, and I saw in her the idea that how we move forward, that there is like a plan. And this sort of goes on this whole thing with the interview, but I don't think we have in this community a system of how to train leaders or how to train people to be on boards. And what the responsibilities are. You can start an organization, but it keeps us just as much work to keep it going, to move the needle. And I'm not sure I see that. And I'm not trying to point the finger on anybody, but maybe there isn't a vision of, because we've been beaten down so much by losing our simple symbol of the Rainbow Crossing, of losing the referendum numerous times, of getting a non-discrimination ordinance. We have the federal government coming into the community and killing people. It's a whole thing about not only our community, but moving all communities forward.
Yeah. And when you speak about Carrie Ann, we're talking about Carrie Ann Morrison, who is the president and board president of Pride Houston 365. Just to clarify, in case anybody doesn't know Carrie Ann and what her role is with this, obviously.
Yeah. And, you know, Carrie Ann came in from somewhere else, and I don't think she was hindered by some of the problems in Pride in the past. And I think she wants to move forward. I'm hoping to convince her to have a couple public meetings where people can discuss what they would like in Pride. I noticed when the parade was canceled. Strangely enough, though, if the parade was was going to happen on its normal day, it didn't rain.
Of course.
Yes. It's the first time the parade was canceled because of rain. But considering how many years the parade happened, this is pretty incredible. But I'm hoping, you know, when it was announced, basically Pride was given 3 Saturdays in August of when they can have the parade. And I know there's a number of people in the community would like to see it move to October. And I'm not speaking from Pride. I'm speaking as a person been involved in Pride in many years. And there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, there's so many things that happen in October in the city because the weather's so nice. And I was always a traditionalist saying we need to have the parade on the anniversary weekend of Stonewall. But it's got much hotter in June than it has before. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are older who just don't want to be out in that weather. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, whatever. But I hope we have a community discussion on this.
I think it's important because I think a lot of people, there was a lot of ire about moving it to August, which frankly, sometimes is hotter than June, if you can believe it.
Yes.
But they really weren't given the option. I mean, there really wasn't like, you can have this because, like you said, October, everybody's trying to get October. It's already booked. And we're talking about an event that's being rescheduled.
What was really interesting, and, you know, usually I go up there and I'm talking about things that the mayor doesn't support or wish he would support. But this time it was a thank you talk. And the mayor was very friendly, and he talked about the fact that he was in the first Pride Parade. And I
can't, he was?
That's what he says. And I'm not going to argue that he wasn't. Now, was he with another group? Was he with the Democrats? Was he whatever? But he said he was there. And he talked about how nice it was to have it in the community and that it was a neighborhood parade. And I was very much against when they moved it downtown that they didn't have an open process in that, like we had an open process in going to the night parade. But the reality is it outgrew Montrose. No two ways about it. And number two, there's no place in Montrose where you can have a large festival. And I know that because we worked for many years. And we may find a vacant lot that we can have a festival for a couple of years, but then the third year it's being developed. I think Pride is open to having some type of event in June to commemorate Stonewall. And, you know, this is all just talk, nothing set in stone. But I'm glad to hear that they're at least open to discussing it.
And I think it's an important discussion to have just because of the logistics of the summer in Houston. And it is getting just hotter and hotter. But, you know, global warming, not a joke.
Well, the other thing was, in my day, we had to deal with two entities. We had to deal with the police department. We had to deal with traffic and transportation. And because there was two MLK parades, they pretty much didn't bother with us. And, you know, after the parade, I'd wait a couple of weeks and I'd call the police department and I'd call traffic and transportation and say, hey, do we have need a meeting? Were there any problems? And usually the answer was no. Nowadays, doing a parade like this involves so much more because of the threat of any large event that happens anywhere, let alone an LGBT event. And the fact that it cost HPD tons of money to have, you know, people watching on the top of those buildings, on the sideways and stuff like that. And it takes a lot more work for the city to put on this parade. So I understand that aspect of it.
Yeah, it's definitely not as easy as assembling people and having them just go down the street. It's a lot of logistics. It's a lot of street closures. It's a lot of security. It's a lot of different things. I mean, I think that people think of it as a more simple process than what it is. But in
a
city this large,
it's a lot more money than it used to cost. And some of the sponsors are walking away. Now, I hear that I believe it's Tampa or St. Pete has closed down their Pride. Tucson shut it down. I know there was problems in Long Beach, California, but that may have been an internal problem. I don't know. But something that we've had enjoyed for 50 plus years, is not necessarily saying that it will continue to happen in some of these cities. On the other hand, what's really interesting is a lot of these smaller cities and towns are having pride events. I mean, where I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, there was an event in Scranton, there was an event in Wilkes-Barre, in Stroudsburg, and some of these cities you never dreamed of having prides. So that's a positive step, but we also need to have it in our bigger cities.
No, absolutely. So we are looking at, in this summer, coming up August 15th, obviously, the rescheduled Pride Parade, Houston. So there we are. That's going to be that one. And hopefully the banners. Do you think that you can get the banners up by then? I mean, is that a realistic thing?
There's a possibility. I will be, okay. You know, the other part of this whole process was trying to work within the system and not going out there and screaming that, hey, we need to get this done. They're not working on it. And I think that would have backfired if we did that approach. I'm going to continue to work with Centerpoint on a professional level and get it going. We're already teeing up, getting them printed and working with the vendor who puts them up to be ready to go once Centerpoint says yes. That we could, you know, we may have rain that may delay it. We may have what? When we get them up, we're going to have a big press conference and we will invite the mayor. So along with some of the other people, I can't say enough for Abby Kamen's council district office. And then it transitioned to Joe Prenzinelli. Salinas's office was incredible also. So it wasn't, I did a lot of work on this, but it was a lot of other people along the way that helped out.
It's nice to hear that the mayor was pretty supportive. I think I questioned some of that after the rainbow crosswalk incident. He's obviously juggling a lot of political hot potatoes at one time.
Yeah, I think we were very disappointed because as soon as the word came down from the governor's office, it was like immediate. There was no like, yes. Hey, let me talk to the governor. Hey, let me, you know, do this. And, you know, I think sometimes he jumps the gun on things rather than saying, hey, is there a way to work on it? Now, you know, his argument was we could lose $100 million worth of money that comes through the governor's office or from the federal office through the governor's office. The day he said they have to come down, they were coming down no matter what we did. But I'm glad the community worked in bringing the attention to it and coming to council and doing what they can and painting the sidewalk with chalk and all the other stuff that they did.
Bless the people that did the building decorations and all of that. I mean, it's still that intersection still feels pretty much representative.
Yeah, and El Paso actually took their decorative street lamps, their street lights, and put rainbow stuff on it. I think we could have done some other stuff, but this is where we are, and hopefully we'll be moving forward.
Well, it sounds like we're moving forward on August 15th. Sweaty with banners up in the air, hopefully. So there you are.
So, yes.
We're going to have our fingers crossed. But nice to know that the city is okayed and now you're just working with Centerpoint and figuring out how the logistics, if you will. Well, thank you, Jack. You know, you do so much for us. I feel like historically you have, and now you're kind of continuing to do it. You never get a break. So there you are, still going forward with all of this. So thank you from all of us.
Well, thank you.
Hi there, this is Brett Cullum, and I'm here with John Marullo. He is a Houston-based author who has created The Brimmerverse. More on that later, but we are here to talk about the second annual Houston LGBTQ plus Independent Author Fair. Now, this is going to be held at the Montrose Center on Saturday, August 1st. It lasts from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m., and it is definitely open to the public, and you'll get to see more than a dozen authors that are from the community. So welcome, John.
Thank you for having me on, Brett.
So what made you want to start this initially, like 2 years ago? What made you want to have an independent author fair for the LGBTQ plus writers?
I published my first book in 2023, and I started making the local independent author fair circuit, and I found that while the general public is, for the most part, very welcoming of different authors, in some areas, particularly one that I went to that was some distance from the city, people would find that I had gay characters, not even that I was gay, but that I had gay characters in my book, and they would politely excuse themselves and walk away. Or they would ask questions about characters, indicating that they thought that they would be like real people who are not known as being LGBTQ allies.
Oh, no.
I think that was diplomatically put. And,
okay.
And T-shirts would be worn by people walking around that were like, you frighten me.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I think that the further out you go from the inner city, I think that it ratchets up a little bit. I mean, obviously. And I think that books are about finding your audience. And there is a certain magic to that and a skill that you have to get them to the right places. I've always wondered, and just a general question, how do new authors even get published these days? I mean, it's wild. What was your journey like?
Well, I started my first book in 2018 as just for fun. I started writing a book during NaNoWriMo, which was National Novel Writing Month, which no longer exists, but that's another story entirely. It was November of 2018. I had a dream and thought, oh, that'd make a great idea for a book, and just started writing it. It just happened to be the beginning of November. I sat with my book for a very long time. I re-edited it, revisited it. I was a librarian for many years. We like to say you're always a librarian when you are one. I will admit I was a little hesitant to do self-publishing because self-publishing was not always thought of well, shall we say. It was even 10 years ago, self-published books were looked on with some scorn in some circles because, oh, well, that person couldn't actually get published. Now, it's become very different. Self-publishing is not necessarily because one can't get published by a traditional house. In some cases, it's wanting to have more freedom over your work. And in other cases, it's understanding that while your book may be very, very popular among a certain demographic, it might not be a major widespread mainstream hit. So it occurred to me that self-publishing was going to be the best way to get my books out there in person for people to read. So I went through a self-publishing company, and I was very happy with the product, and I've published two of my books so far.
You're two books in, and it's a series, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Projected 7 book series. I have 5 completed drafts. So there are 3 books that have been written at least in the first draft and will be published at some point, and then 2 more that I have yet to write that I have mapped out in my head.
That is wild that you've got 7 books in you already. Now, what was the name of the first 2 that are published that are available in case we want to go look for them?
They are Behold All the Dwellers Upon Earth, and the second is Most Heartily We Beseech Thee. I'll say those titles again because they're both a mouthful. Behold All the Dwellers Upon Earth is volume 1. Volume 2 is Most Heartily We Beseech Thee.
And what's the quick overview of what they're about? There is one.
Yeah, you and I have talked about my books before, so I know that you know that it's a bit complicated. But the Brimmerverse series is about a different world where, very much like our own, where some people have supernatural abilities. Hey, it's fantasy, of course. And one in particular, Nathan Brimmer, decides to use his to help try to make the world a better place. And it's the story of the Brimmer family, hence the Brimmerverse. And I'm my own fandom. And the characters just went from there. His twin sons, David and James William, are the 2 characters everyone connects with. They are the most powerful of them all, and they know things that other people don't know. And they tell their father, okay, you have to do this. You have to listen to us when we tell you things. They tell them that when they're 5. So It's
as a 5-year-old does.
As a 5-year-old does. And they're the characters everyone connects with, it seems, and that's totally fine. I like it that way. They're my favorite characters to write.
Mm-hmm. Now, your books are fantasy, yes. But this event that's coming up in August, what types of authors come to this event? I mean, is it a variety?
It is indeed. We have authors who write their fantasy is quite possibly the most common, because I think there's always that connection between queer people and fantasy that is always going to be there, because we all want the world to be better. But so there is fantasy is definitely the most common, but we also have historic fiction, biography, cookbook, poetry. Let me see. This year we have the children's book author for the first time. We did not have one last year, so that's really cool. We have really a variety. Some are more a fiction and nonfiction. It is, you know, just a general work of literary presence, I guess.
Yeah, that's a mouthful too. Literary.
It is. I'm good at that.
Well, I went to the first one, obviously. Actually, I helped one of the authors with their booth, and I was so impressed with the variety of people. Like you said, poetry. I mean, I walked out with a book of poetry. You know, it was just amazing that there was that breadth. And just like our community, I think there's a lot of different things and a lot of different interests and a lot of different expressions, if you will. So it's been interesting to see that. What do you think it's like for people attending? I mean, what do you want people to get out of this?
Well, I want people to be exposed to new writers that they might not be able to connect to otherwise, because they may not be as readily available. You know, my books are in the public library because I know because they're in the local author collection, because I knew how to do that because I used to work for them. But they're not necessarily going to be in the public library or at Barnes & Noble, because they're, you know, unless people specifically ask for them, they aren't going to be. So, and they might be hard to find on something like Amazon. So this is a way people can find LGBTQ authors they may not have been able to find otherwise. Also to support local authors, which is we have a lot of wonderful talent in the Houston community. One of our authors is from Austin, but all the rest are Houston area authors. And it's just really great to be able to support local authors and what they do.
It's amazing that we have all of this local talent. I mean, I see it all the time in other art forms as well, but it seems like the authors really, it's fascinating to see how many we have. What do you think it takes to write a book? I mean, does everybody have a book in them, or is it just one of those things? I mean, what advice would you give to somebody that said, hey, I want to write a book, but I don't know where to start, or I've got this idea, and where do I go?
It took me a long time. I've always wanted to write books since I was little. The dedication to my second book is to my mother, and I say the first person who knew I was going to write a book. And that's been always something that I've wanted to do, but I felt that I part of it was I could never focus. What worked well for me, honestly, was having this that referred to National Novel Writing Month. It's now called Novel November, where the goal is within the month of November to finish writing a 50,000 word novel. That worked really well for me because I was able to track my progress really well and had a definite goal in mind that, okay, this is how much I have to write to get this done by this day. I participated in events like that 5 times, each of my 5 books, and 3 of the times I did finish within November. The first, I just was going in totally unprepared, by the seat of my pants, as it were, and it didn't. I finished it in January, and then the fifth one, was this most recent one. It took me a while afterward. That really is, I think, to be able to have that framework is very helpful. Now, for other people, they may be disciplined enough just to say, okay, I'm going to write every day from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. or something. I know that doesn't happen for me. My life's a bit more unpredictable. As to whether everyone has a book in them, that's kind of hard to say. I think a lot of people do, but you know, then there are many people who just would never want to try writing. So, you know, I think most people do have something creative in them, and they just need to find the way to hone it and unleash it.
Well, and of course, Saturday, August 1st, you get to see a lot of people that have a lot of discipline and obviously produce a lot. And you're holding this at the Mantra Center, of course.
Yes.
And thankfully in August, where it's an indoor event with air conditioning.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's so funny. And it's so funny because this year you planned this to not be during Pride Month, but ironically, you're in Pride Month because yes. They moved the Pride thing. So
yes,
there you
Pride
are.
Part two. There we go. Yeah. There's so much that goes on in June every year that I figured if we had it in August, if we had it a little later in the summer, it might have less competition. And it still does, although there are other things going on that day at the Montrose Center. But it does have, but it makes it a little easier. Also, I find that, you know, people don't necessarily have a lot to do on an August Saturday. And, you know, who wants to be outside in Houston in August? So having an indoor event is great. And in fact, as of today, as of our recording this, we are in a larger room. We were in room
one. Well.
We were in room 111, I believe, last year, or 112. We're now going to be in room 106, which is a larger room. You are the first to learn of that. I haven't had a chance to send the email to the other authors just yet, but that will happen today. So yes, we are going to be in a larger room this year, easier to get into. Also, it's right by the elevators and by the main entrance. So we think we will have a lot of people finding us. We have a couple of partnerships this year with other organizations, Montrose Center, of course, and the Harris County LGBTQIA Commission. And this year, we have one more partner, and that is my former workplace, the Houston Public Library. Very glad they will be there.
That is amazing. Way to expand that one. You know, what do you think? I know I'm talking to a librarian, but why is it important to our community? Why are books important to the LGBTQIA plus community?
Well, I know when I first came out, which was in the last century, when I was very young, you know, before we had the internet, that was the way we found out about being gay. And while we can still find basic information more easily, this is how we find our stories, how we find who we are as people. And the LGBTQ experience is not monolithic. It is very diverse, and it allows us to find different ways that people have found that they, you know, have found themselves and that it, in their lives. In my books, several of the characters are gay. In the later books, we have some lesbian and trans characters as well. And it's in their lives, it's very much treated as just matter for the course. But it's, I remember saying in one of the books, it takes place a bit in the future, it wasn't always this way. We used to have to be very careful. And it's important that our stories are known and that our stories are told and that other people get to read about them. And of course, we even welcome straight people.
We're not going to check your card at the door.
Right.
You are more than welcome to buy a book.
Absolutely.
Well, the great thing is this is a totally free event to anybody that attends. So Montrose Center, Saturday, August 1st, 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. So totally air conditioned, bunch of authors that offer a bunch of different genres. Really great. I'm so glad that you established this because it's such a nice way to build a community within a community. It's like you can kind of see the LGBTQIA plus community, but you can also see the authors of that community, and they kind of create their own little world, their own little verse, if you will, like the Riververse. Yes. Well, thank you, John. I appreciate you telling me all about this and your inspirations. And we will see you on Saturday in August, the first Saturday.
Thank you very much, Brett. I appreciate it. Take care.
This radio program, Queer Voices, has existed since the 1970s on KPFT. We have this little crew of folks working every week to produce what's no longer unique because we're almost mainstream now. but we're still an important voice that might not otherwise get heard because it's not on that many places. So KPFT is very important to give voices to those who might not otherwise have voices. So as Glenn always says, you participate by listening. You should also participate by supporting the station. So please go to kpft.org and make your donation right away.
Hi there, I am Brett Cullum, and in April of 2025, Shunya Theater presented A Nice Indian Boy for only 3 days at the Match. Now, it sold out every performance. And now, the play from Madhuri Shikhar will get a revival brought to us by a new company, Aerial Roots Theater Company. And it's going to be at the Asia Society Texas's Brown Theater, which is a wonderful space, from July 31st to August 9th. Now, they're bringing back almost all of the original cast, save for one. They will all be back on board for this revival. And just to remind you, the play's premise is that a meet-cute at a temple results in a romance between Naveen Gavaskar and Keshav, a Hindi-speaking, Bollywood-loving man who happens to be white. And as the love story unfolds, the Gavaskar household must also brace itself for the return of Naveen's older sister, Arundhati. Today, I have Anjana Menon, Tahir Lakhandwala, and Chad Fontenot with me to talk about this Southern Asian romantic comedy. So welcome, everybody.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank you so much, Brett.
Okay, so right off the bat, I have to ask, why resurrect this one? You had the hit, right? So now you're going to resurrect it.
We felt very, very much at the end of the last run that we were not done telling the story. Yeah. For one, we had rehearsed this for so long, and to just do the 5 shows over three, four days was really not enough. Like, for not just like the cast and the creative team, but also for audiences, because we had a lot of people share how deeply this touched them and how much more they wanted to see. A lot of people, because we were sold out at Match One, we had so many people who couldn't actually make it to the show when we performed it in 2025. So yes, long story short, this is why.
Well, it's a new company, right? And you're founded by, tell me who else involved in creating this, Aerial Roots Theater Company.
Myself, Tahir, and our co-founder, Nidhi Varghese, who also was our assistant director and stage manager of the first installment of this play.
So a lot of familiar faces.
Yes.
There you go. Well, what's going to be different this time around? What are you kind of adding to the mix?
We have, first of all, the venue is at the Brown Theater at Asia Society is a lot bigger, and it's very different. This is a proscenium. We performed this in a thrust the last time. And so we have a different set. And this time our set is designed by Afsana Ayani, you know, Houston's favorite set designer. Much loved. And of course, our lead is different. We have Chad this time, Chad playing Keshav. And that you'd be surprised how much that changes the actual dynamic of the entire cast in a good way.
Yeah, Chad, how does it feel to be the new kid on the block?
It's great. I will say that there does seem to be a ghost in the room sometimes, because everyone will turn to be like, well, not in a bad way necessarily, but it's not a roadblock, but it's definitely interesting, a first time experience to go into a production where everyone has done it before. They have made that familial bond. So I guess there's a little bit of method acting in that way, to sort of be a stranger in somebody else's house, you know? So it's very interesting how that parallel can, you know, I have a well, you know, essentially, that these people are all laughing about the last time we did this, ha, ha, ha. And I'm like, you know, it's endearing. It really is. But it's interesting. It's a very unique experience.
Well, it kind of fits the character, though, doesn't it? I mean, it's this guy that's coming into a family. You know, they all know each other, and they've known each other for years, and you're the outsider. So, hey.
And that's not well that I talk about, you know. It's not.
Just work it out.
What I'm experiencing, you know. So yeah. It's very cool.
It's Tahir,
does that change anything for you?
For me?
No, for Tahir.
Oh, yes. I think absolutely, right? So, like, I think particularly the two main characters' relationships, like, are very informed by kind of their interactions to each other, right? And like how, like, Chad he brings a different energy, a new energy to Keshav's character sort of has a different cadence of speech and movement. And so how we move on stage, how we interact even in scenes where we're like more intimate and when perhaps when we're even with the broader cast, like all of those dynamics are just very different between us. And so I'm truly kind of enjoying exploring a different way of being for Naveen, right? Because I feel like I've inhabited Naveen before, and this is sort of a new Keshav in Naveen's life. But in many ways, it's like it's been so fun to kind of revisit that.
Yeah, it's like his second marriage.
Yeah, with the kidding. Same person,
with the same name.
Now, like, before, yeah,
you have a type. Okay,
there you go.
What can I say?
Well, how did you find Chad?
Chad and I have actually worked before together on.
Okay.
I've lost count now. How many?
Just one. Was it not? I feel like
one?
Might have been before. Honeycomb Trilogy.
Yes, Honeycomb Trilogy was the first one. Synapse. Yeah. And then we recently were in Zoom Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
My favorite.
Oh my gosh.
Nurse, but...
Yes.
Yes. No, Anjana, you played the nurse. Right?
I played the nurse. I did. Yes.
Oh my gosh. That's a great role.
It was wonderful. I'm speaking for Chad, but the room was just so full of love and kindness that we really enjoyed the entire process. And of course, Chad and I had a scene together where him as Mercutio and me as the nurse, we loved that little banter, the energy. It was different every night, and it was always enjoyable.
Real life between us was really, really quite something. I always love sharing stage and space with you, Anjana.
She's
consummate. Very generous actor. And director.
Oh my goodness. I can't even. I love you.
It's such a love fest in here. And I think that was what was so wonderful about A Nice Indian Boy when you first produced it, is it really was. I mean, we do have this central love story, but it's so much more than that because it's the family and it's this whole representation of, you know, the family and their traditions and their food and, I mean, just everything else. And it's just such a nice view into that. I think that's part of why it did so well. Apart from the fact that probably all the aunties bought out every seat.
Yeah.
But
aunties, we need you to do it again.
Yes. Come on back.
And I would say, like, you know, going back to Aerial Roots and sort of our mission and founding, right, is like we want to tell stories for the South Asian diaspora and the people who love us. And like, I think as the South Asian community in the U.S. evolves and the diaspora evolves, a lot of these stories like need to be put front and center. And I think this is why this is such a great play to like kickstart our company, right? Particularly at a time where there's this intersection happening in our society of both, you know, queer rights and perhaps rights of like other minorities, you know, being up for question, I would say. And so it's a really good story to tell, particularly following on from Pride Month, that reflects kind of who we are and who we want to be as a company. And to Anjana's point, I hope many, many aunties and uncles and
everyone, their daughters and their sons and their second cousins and their, you know,
yeah. And their dogs.
Everybody's welcome.
Well, and this time around, you're doing it in the Asia Society, Texas's theater, which is a spectacular space. I've seen performers in there before.
Yeah.
Really beautiful theater. And it doesn't seem to get used as much as I would like. So I'm glad to see you in there. How does that change your dynamic a little bit?
So much, because at match one, with the setting being really intimate, there was, you know, there were moments between the cast that we were able to, or rather that I choreographed in a certain sense to play up that intimacy. And I think we're going to lose a lot of that on the scale of the stage. But at the same time, along with Afsana's wonderful set, there's just like, it's a story happening on this backdrop that it's almost like we're zooming out to see like a larger level of the story, which I think it is the same script, but it's a different look at it, if that makes sense.
And I think it's probably also a great point. Like, we love the fact that we get to do this with Asia Society, and it so aligns with sort of our missions, also feel so aligned.
Yeah.
Also, shout out here to Matt Fuller and Megan Sham and Chelsea D'Souza, who've been awesome to work with. And we're very excited to be collaborating.
Yes.
Well, I think what it's going to give you, if I'm not wrong, is going to give you a more cinematic quality. And the last time that we talked, it was before this came out as a film. So I need to know, because it was hanging in the air last time, what did you all think of the Jonathan Groff-led romantic comedy that hit screens a year ago and is actually able to be streamed now?
Yeah,
that's right. We actually, a little backstory, we made it. It was released right at the time that we were in tech for the show. And so we weren't able to go catch it in the theaters. But when it did hit streaming, we had like a little watch party at my house and we had everybody come together and we all sat down to watch the movie. It has its elements. There are elements of the film that are really very similar to what we see in the play, but they have taken certain relationships and sort of magnified, you know, to reflect a dynamic that honestly I didn't see in the play when I read it as a director. And so it was interesting to see that perspective from another director's point of view. I am partial to the play. I will say that I like the play. It is very much the same story. And I think I want to add that so many people still found value in it. And I think that's the important takeaway, is that they still felt represented. They still felt like a story was being told. And at the end of the day, that's really what matters.
Was Jonathan Groff Cindy? Was it good?
It was all right, actually. Yeah.
He sang that one song that was, you know, right outside of the theater, and he gave his own Jonathan Groff little flair to it really nobody could have expected. And so it was good. Yeah.
I will say it doesn't hold a candle to Chad, though.
I can't speak on that because I've been requested not to watch the film.
Oh, really? No. I was going to ask you, did you see the original production at the Match?
I had a chance to at Match. So this whole world, I have, you know, only what we're building as reference for the material, which I think is very special. So I did ask Anjana last rehearsal if I could go watch it, because it's on my canopy for the LGBT cinema for this month. It's free for streaming. And she said no, which I respect. You know, I want to see it just for like, well, what are people might be most familiar with that come in to see this and, you know, sort of meet or subvert their expectations. But that's going to happen one way or the other, you know. So I like the idea of not having a reference other than what we're building into space.
Yeah.
I will say, and I will admit, I was a lot more forceful in my opinion the last time, Tahir will agree, telling people not to go watch the film because... And I honestly, I didn't know what to expect with the film, but I knew that the world that we'd created is so specific to the vision that, you know, we carried in our little team that it would have been disorienting. And I do, you know, I cannot force people to to not go watch the movie. But I do believe that it's the two worlds will probably clash, especially if we're trying to find a place for this character here in the story.
Well, I think the wonderful thing, and I did see the production prior that you did in April of 2025, it felt like a family. I mean, it felt very much like that. And I think that was what I took away. And hopefully that's what you wanted, is it felt very authentic. And I think the character of Keshav kind of just became part of that family, and it all worked. It was a great commentary on that. It's a great love story in a lot of ways. I mean, it's not just the love story between Naveen and Keshav. It's the love story between the whole family. The sister, the older sister, Arundhati, she's so funny. All of the things that happen are just kind of everything that you want out of a family comedy. So I definitely encourage people to see it and maybe save the movie for afterwards. That might be a good idea. Yeah. I always like to do that. And as an actor, Chad, I think that's the smartest thing to do. Don't watch it because, you know, it's so easy to get that in your head. Yeah. So it's nice. I've done that a lot with roles when I played them and then gone back and watched the movie afterwards and then gone, oh my gosh.
What? Right. I think just a tiny little anecdote. I didn't watch anything for our Romeo and Juliet for Mercutio, except one thing. And that was the big long Queen Mab speech. I was like, there's at least some expectation to do this a certain way, you know? So that's the only thing I ever looked up. But for a play like this, it's going to be much more from the heart if I don't have a reference. So, you know, I softened up, and she was forceful, but I softened up.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, if there's anything that Anja can be, it is forceful. So there you go.
Strong leader of the helm is what the
director should be. Yes.
Okay, so back to Aerial Roots Theater Company.
Yes.
This is your inaugural production. And then you had mentioned kind of an idea of what you want to go forward with. But is there anything planned at this point? Or are you just kind of getting through a nice Indian boy July 31st to August 9th mm-hmm. and then plan?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we do. We're going over each other. We do have a plan. So our next show is in March of next year. We will announce it shortly after. Our focus is obviously on like knocking out this first show at the park. And then we obviously would want to love to continue to engage with our supporters and our audiences in between August and March. So be on the lookout for events. Follow us on Instagram at AerialRootsHTX. We'll put a bunch of stuff up there that's hopefully fun and exciting for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stay tuned.
I want to encourage you, include food.
100%. Listen, we're South Asian. How could we not?
When I watched The Nice Indian Boy, I was like, why can't we have some of this food? You know, there's a Broadway version of Oklahoma, I think, where they serve a meal during the intermission. Maybe this could be a thing. I don't think that the Asia Society of Texas would love that too much, though. Might be messy. But thank you all so much. I'm so excited to see this in another incarnation. It really impressed me the last time. And I hate that, like you said, it was a 3-night run.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really get my friends there because it had already sold out. So this time I really am planning on bringing some friends and forcing them to sit down and watch this and appreciate it, because I think it has a lot to say, not only to so many communities, the LGBTQIA+ community, you've got the South Asian community, you've got just the community of just America at 250 years old and facing all of this.
I think that what's the beauty of the play is that so many members of our audience who were not part of either community, the queer or the South Asian community, still found value in it and still loved it. And I would encourage people to take a chance and come watch. You know,
yeah.
Back from it.
Very funny and very great. And I'm sure that bringing Chad in will continue to elevate it and make it feel just as special as it was back then. So, and then of course, Tahir. Now you're old hat. Last time we talked, you hadn't been on the stage in how many years? Like 10?
And this is like now, you know, just I'm a repeat performer now. It's just it's become part of me. So, which I'm very glad for.
You've got the bug. So there you go. And then of course, Chad Fontenot. We know you from like a whole bunch of stuff. So there you go.
No, they agree. It's awesome. It feels like an episode of All in the Family. If you're familiar with that old sitcom, I used to watch that all the time when I was younger. So it's very topical. It deals with hard topics, but it's hilarious at the same time. So very fortunate to be a part of this.
Yeah. Well, break legs in this new
studio.
And I'm so excited to see you.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast, available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hundreds of millions of people around the world lack easy access to safe drinking water, and water scarcity is expected to worsen as droughts become more extreme.
With climate change, water is just becoming a bigger issue.
Robert Foster is the chairman of the American Solar Energy Society. He says one small-scale solution is to use the sun to purify any water that is available, such as contaminated well water. It's an age-old technique called solar distillation. The sun heats up water in a glass-covered basin. The water evaporates, leaving salt and impurities behind. That pure water vapor condenses on the glass and runs down to a trough where it can be collected. Foster says most stills produce only a couple gallons of drinking water each day, but it can help people who have few other options. Foster has helped equip families along the U.S.-Mexico border with solar stills to purify well water polluted with arsenic and fluoride. And he's worked with Pacific Islanders who use stills to turn salt water into fresh drinkable water.
So it's a great opportunity for people to clean their water who might not otherwise have an easy way to do it. You don't need electricity, you just need sunlight.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KPFT Programmer Profile.
Hi there, this is Dwayne Bradley, host of the Open Journal program.